You live in three places in the world: New York, Buenos Aires, and Hong Kong, and you've dedicated your book to the welcoming people of Hong Kong and Buenos Aires. How does the world economy look depending on where you are?
Well, there's only one global economy, so it really should look the same, but of course, you get different local perspectives wherever you are. I mean, Hong Kong is a place of quite marked contrasts, but it is a place where you have an incredible concentration of financial firms and other high-priced services firms. So you have glistening towers of steel and glass and very clean facilities, and you can feel the wealth in that place. Whereas in Argentina, it's not quite as well-to-do, and you don't have so many places like that. You get more of a sense of the day-to-day struggle to keep a family fed.
I've noticed when I've traveled abroad that maybe not so much on financial matters, but on world news, especially American interventions abroad, get looked at very differently in Europe or the Middle East than they do in the US. Is there any change in the way economic news gets reported, especially the current American crisis?
Absolutely. I mean, Hong Kong feels very connected to the great financial centers of the world like New York and London. You really get a fairly similar perspective there from what you might get in New York. Argentina, Buenos Aires is totally different. The president of the country here, Cristina Kirchner, actually made a point of saying that even though the great markets of the world are trembling, Argentina is strong and safe, and she almost was triumphalist in what has been a fairly adversarial relationship with the United States lately. And some people even said there was a personal aspect to it, that some Argentine banker at Lehman Brothers had been giving bad forecasts about Argentina, and she was especially pleased to see that firm go down. So you have all sorts of idiosyncrasies on the local level.
And of course, Argentina went through what for its own people was a much worse crisis a decade ago.
Absolutely. I mean, Argentina felt much closer to what the United States experienced in the Great Depression than anything the U.S. is going through right now. I mean, there was unemployment over 25% here, as there was in the United States during the Great Depression. I think you wouldn't find many analysts in the United States who are predicting unemployment over 10%.
One of the things that happens when countries run into trouble is the International Monetary Fund steps in or tries to step in. This isn't as much true as it used to be, and it's certainly not true in the US today, but it was in Argentina.
That's right. And there has been a very adversarial relationship with the IMF as well, and not just in Argentina. I would say that what did the most damage to the fund's reputation was the way it acted after the Russian and Asian financial crisis of the late 90s. It really was repudiated by many countries in East Asia, including South Korea and Indonesia, for giving bad policy advice in the aftermath. And some countries that deliberately did not follow its advice, like Malaysia, were some of the ones that came out of that crisis looking the best. And that's something that I go into in the book, is sort of who's running the global economic governance. You know, is there really someone you can look to make the right policy choices? A lot of times the U.S. sort of nominates itself to be the prescriber of best policy. But, you know, now increasingly we're seeing doubts about that.
You have various topics in the book. When does working together really work? That's for different corporations. Can governments make global markets more competitive? How do the credit markets and currencies run? Who controls the world's money supply, and so on? So much of it seems to depend on the interaction of private companies and world governments, and that's a very messy business.
Absolutely. There's just a lot of gray areas there. No country has complete government control of the economy. No country has complete hands-off, laissez-faire attitudes either. So what you're seeing is lots of different shades of gray all around the world, and some of them which change in unpredictable ways. I mean, in China, for example, which is now one of the biggest economies in the world and may be the biggest sometime in the middle of this coming century, you have what started out as supposedly a communist system, which has now become a sort of authoritarian brand of capitalism. And in fact, there are some aspects of it which some people would argue are more capitalist than even Western Europe.
There's also a big difference in the way central banks interact with the economies in different countries. The U.S. Federal Reserve has been very proactive in the last week or two, that the Federal Reserve and the Treasury Department. In other places like the European Union, it seems a lot harder for them to behave that way.
Absolutely. They have a much more narrowly defined mandate in the European Union. This is something that I've written about as well in the book. In the European Union, they're really supposed to just focus on maintaining stable prices, a low level of inflation, and not worry so much about, or even not worry at all about, economic growth. Their job is just to take care of the inflation part of the picture. The Federal Reserve has a much broader mandate. It's supposed to set a balance between employment and keeping inflation low. And it's sort of under that broad mandate that it can step in and say, hey, we're going to take over the world's biggest insurance company. That could certainly never happen, at least under current policy rules, at the European Central Bank. And I think that that's part of the reason why a lot of people around the world are looking sort of stunned at what has happened this week, because it wouldn't even have entered their minds that this was a possibility. And yet here it is, it's happened.
You know, some people like Congressman Ron Paul have come out and said it's flat out unconstitutional, that Congress should be doing this rather than the Fed.
Well, the thing is that the Fed is where the money is. And obviously Congress has a lot of power to make spending decisions, but it takes a long time to get that kind of stuff through Congress. I think that the folks at the Fed and at the Treasury decided that the time to act was now, specifically over this past week. And, you know, they didn't see anything telling them that they couldn't do it, so they did it. And I think that might be true. This may just be a hole in our definition of these institutions. We never thought that this would happen, so we don't know whether it's really part of the game plan or not. We're sort of in that gray area which exists within our legal framework, but doesn't really have specific rules attached to it, sort of like in the presidential election 8 years ago. So, you know, this is a very exciting time for people who watch the markets, because we want to see what happens. We want to see how these institutions continue to define themselves. And people all around the world will be watching very carefully, because, you know, there's just really one global market for credit, which is what's at the base of all of this. And every incursion into those markets by any government affects every other person in the world who's borrowing or lending money.
Again and again in the book, you emphasize the power of markets, and you tend to sometimes have an almost laissez-faire attitude that if the markets would be left alone, they would correct themselves, and that sometimes it's a good idea to let businesses fail. But at other times, you emphasize the importance of transparency, lack of corruption, a free flow of information, and so on. And this seems to depend on governments to keep the whole thing together.
Yeah, I think you won't find many economists who would disagree with the idea that competitive markets function best when there's a strong legal framework backing them up, which includes things like transparent accounting. You can try and have competitive markets under all sorts of circumstances. If you don't have any legal rules at all, then you're just going to end up with the Wild West, and that's not very efficient. You need to have that legal framework in the background that's making sure people keep their noses clean, that investors are protected, and that there's a certain amount of information that's being shared on both sides of the corporate system. Now, at the same time, though, I think it's important to see that as you open markets and make them more competitive, there are always winners and losers. And one of the other jobs of government is to try and manage that transition so that the losers are protected and compensated if necessary when the gainers are making big gains.
Yeah, you especially emphasize that in the case of workers. When industries move from one place to another, the best thing to do instead of trying to keep them going might be to retrain and help out the losers, but realize you can't stop the overall trend.
Yeah, I mean, it's true for globalization as a whole. We really can't stop the overall trend, and nor necessarily should we try. But what we should do is try and manage that transition. And it's something that we're, A, not really that interested in. Unfortunately, there's just not a lot of effort in society and in government to try and take these issues on directly. We have a couple of little programs that are supposed to help companies and workers deal with the effects of international competition, but they're really not that big, and they're not that successful. So the second part is that we're not very good at it yet. So we need to get more interested in it and get more expertise in how to do it so that we don't leave a whole bunch of people behind as we move forward with globalization.
On opposite sides of the political spectrum, I've heard people say in the last week that one of the causes of our current crisis is the essentially revoking the Glass-Steagall Act, banking control regulations of the 30s, which kept investment and commercial banks separate. Other people have said that one of the problems was that people like Congressman Barney Frank or Senator Christopher Dodd kept Congress from investigating Freddie and Fannie.
Well, I think those are two separate questions. On the first one, I would say that you can't blame the erosion of the Glass-Steagall Act for this, because when you look at some of the big names that went down, some of them were pure investment banks, and that had nothing to do with the association with any sort of commercial banking activities. Lehman Brothers didn't have any commercial banking activities, but it made a lot of bad bets, and it got stung. On the other side, if you look at Freddie and Fannie, people have had questions about Freddie and Fannie for years. I mean, I remember when I was back at the New York Times some 6 years ago, and we were writing stories about it then, different problems, but the same sort of suspicions, and also the same lack of definition about what these institutions really were they public or were they private? And, you know, that never really got resolved to anybody's satisfaction, and not surprising that we ended up finding more dirty laundry. I don't know who to blame exactly for the fact that they weren't investigated more fully, but at that point in time, I'm not sure we knew exactly what we were looking for either. I think a lot of the fault also lies with some of the rating agencies who stamped their ratings on these companies, even though they themselves didn't really understand what these companies were doing and what they were investing in. And I think that's just a huge, huge dropping of the ball.
So would you recommend a greater control over the amount of a bank can be leveraged? It had been, I think, no more than 12 times its assets until the early 2000s, and that was relaxed for five big companies, three of which have just gone under.
Well, I think that if you look forward and you ask, what can we do to make this situation better in the future, to stop having to do things like bail out AIG, what you want to make sure is that no single company has the ability to send the markets reeling. And this is something that I have a whole chapter devoted to in the book, which is why the financial markets are vulnerable to the actions of just one person or one company. And what you're really looking for is looking for ways to measure the influence of companies. You know, if it's a very small bank that's highly leveraged, that doesn't really matter, because even highly leveraged is not going to have a huge effect on the markets. What you really want to look out for are these banks and other financial institutions that are tied into every part of the global economy or every part of the global financial markets. And if they go down, then you get a lot of people in trouble. You want to be on the watch for them. And, you know, in theory, you might want an agency that identifies them, warns them, asks them to slim down, or actually forcibly breaks them up.
Yeah, you spoke of a proposal that Lawrence Summers and his wife made a decade ago that I guess it got nowhere, for funding a watchdog agency.
Yeah, I mean, and they had other proposals as well, such as putting a little, as they used to say, sand in the gears of the global economy, or at least financial markets, by putting a small, tiny, tiny little tax on financial transactions so that things couldn't get out of hand very quickly, because people would think twice about the rapidity with which they made trades. That proposal didn't really get anywhere either, but I'm sure you're going to hear a little bit more about it now, especially as we try and clamp down on short selling. If you just look at what happened to United Airlines last week, when a false rumor came out about them that they were going bankrupt and the share price tanked and then was back up within hours, I mean, that kind of stuff happens because of the rapidity with which we can trade and the way computer trading systems work. And, you know, it's probably worth taking another look to see if those kinds of things can be rationalized a bit. We haven't really looked at that very seriously back since October 87, when we had the last big crash.
Your book concentrates on one day in June, a little over 3 years ago. Things have changed, gotten even more interconnected probably, and even larger scale in those 3 years. Do you think the actions that the Fed and the Treasury Department recently took would have been possible 3 years ago, would have been politically possible? Or I guess I'm trying to say, are things in better hands now, or are things more dangerous now?
It's a really interesting question, because I think you have a couple different factors going into what we've seen this week. One is the administration is up against the wall. They have no choice. They have to act. Even if they are laissez-faire types in philosophy, the fact is that they need to do something now. They've left themselves with no other choices because they haven't done anything before to stave off these problems. The second question is, you know, would a different administration have known what to do? Hard to say because, as we know, the Democratic Party is not usually as tied into Wall Street as the Republican Party is. Sometimes doesn't take as much of an interest in Wall Street. And so you wonder who would have been watching more closely. I don't know. The Democrats might have been more inclined to regulate, which is what needed to happen before, but would they have been looking at the right sort of problem? I just don't know the answer to that question. I think what's really going to tell is what the next administration does into the future, how we improve financial regulation and monitoring into the future.